The Coin Week podcast is brought to you by PCGS. The January-February edition of the Rare Coin Market Report is out now. Now edited by our friend and former Coin Week staff writer Josh McMahon Hernandez, the PCGS Rare Coin Market Report offers the latest look at rare coin prices, insightful articles from leading experts, and PCGS's renowned and gorgeous coin photography. Also, you can celebrate PCGS's 35th anniversary with new limited edition coin inserts, all featuring state-of-the-art security features that will give you peace of mind. Visit www.pcgs.com to learn more. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Coin Week podcast. This week, we have a very interesting conversation with two of Coin Week's writers, Chris Bullfinch, who is co-hosted last week's episode of the Coin Week podcast with me, and Tyler Rossi, who writes mostly about ancient coins and world coins for Coin Week. Amazingly, Tyler and Chris have been lifelong friends, and they got to know each other and the hobby when they were scouts, proving that investment and young numismatists sometimes pays off and allows for a new generation of collectors to enter into the field. So I would like to introduce you to Chris Bullfinch and Tyler and allow them to describe what it was about coin collecting that got them involved in the hobby and how thinking about coins as writers has changed the way they approach the hobby. So gentlemen, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much. This is going to be fun.
So tell me how this happened. So you guys grew up in the same town, and that's you didn't know each other except for the community scouting scene, or you guys go to the same school?
Yeah, so our older brothers are the same age, and though they went to different high schools, you know, they were in the same class for a period of time, and then I knew, and they knew each other probably a little bit. And then the town we live in is fairly small, so people tend to get to know one another, or at least aware of one another. So then when I joined Boy Scouts, I got to know Tyler a little bit. Tyler's 2 years older than I am, so he was a couple years ahead of me in school and scouts. But so we got to know each other, and our families got to know each other a little bit through scouts and just through living in this relatively small town.
Yeah, and then we would like bump into each other at the beach or at the local park or whatever. Through scouts, we both apparently decided to do the coin collecting merit badge at the same time. I'm not sure about Chris, but my dad had already given me some stuff, a handful of 1800s matron head cents, basically. I started getting involved with the coin collecting merit badge, and Chris joined me, and we started doing the badge. And then I don't really remember much about that, but I do remember one of the requirements was we had to go to a coin show, and there was another scout, Nikhil Patel. I don't really know where he ended up. I think Chris keeps
he lives in Arizona, and he went to college in Texas. I'm actually I still talk to him fairly regularly, so I'm gonna send him a link to this because I think he'd
get out of it. And then his dad took us to the Boston area, the Bay show.
The Bay State Coin Show. What year would that would have been? 2007 or 2008?
I mean, I wasn't in high school yet, so it was before 12. That's all I know.
Yeah.
So I remember that we got some really awesome coins. I remember I was just flabbergasted by how big it was, how many cool coins there were. Granted, they're always the surly dealers, but the nice ones let you look at all their stuff. And as like a little kid looking at this just like table full of gold and silver coins from like the 1600s, it was so freaking cool. I remember I ended up with like a Morgan dollar. I ended up with like a cheapo $5 late Roman bronze coin. A broken El Cazador. I think it's a 2 or 4 real, but
we all bought one because they had them for $5 each with a little certificate of authenticity, and then they clipped they clipped the 2x2 to, or at least maybe I clipped the 2x2 to the sheet, but I, well, I remember buying those.
I still have the COA, so
yeah, me too. And you know what's funny? You brought up the late Roman bronzes. That's one of my most vivid memories from the show. Was whichever dealer, I don't know if you and I actually went to the table together, but I remember going to the table and buying, you know, for 10 or 15 bucks, a pretty decent looking Constantine the First, you know, generic bronze piece. And then the guy threw in a much lower grade bronze piece with Constantine the Second. And I just thought it was kind of cool to have the consecutive emperors. And
yeah, mine literally, I don't even know if I could identify it today. I probably could if I spent time on it. But like with collecting, You asked us earlier about like how we collect and how the how our experiences through the industry and the hobby have impacted our own collecting styles, and I'll get into that more later. But I think the one thing is I try and keep kind of mementos of my collecting journey. So while I'll buy and sell most of my coins, like there are a few I'm attached to, but the ones my dad gave me, because he gave me a bunch more after I got the badge. But then ones that are like important to me from events. So like I'm never going to sell the coins from that show because they're basically how I got into the hobby. There's like a Tetradrachm that I got from a guy a couple years later that I really love and that represents my move from American modern to ancient, and I'll never get rid of that one. So I don't know if Chris has that, but I definitely have coins that I will hold on to that have sentimental value well beyond their numismatic or just financial value.
Yeah, I would never part with the coins in either of my grandfather's collections. And that's how I get into it. Tyler mentioned that his dad had given him a few coins to kind of get him started. I had a similar experience, but with different family members having sort of introduced me to it. My paternal grandfather was an officer in the Navy during World War II. He was a second lieutenant, I believe, in the Naval Reserve, and he served on a destroyer escort. He eventually rose up to become its commanding officer. I don't know that they ever actually promoted him. I'd think that they probably were just shifting. I don't know the story behind it, though we do have the history in my house, which I should probably brush up on. But so he served on the ship that operated in both the Atlantic and Pacific theaters. And he would take, he would get mementos from all the different places that he went. And he would buy postcards, and he took a lot of photos, so we have those. But he also tried to get coins from the different places he went and tried to bring a few back. And my older brother and I, when we were, you know, growing up, were kind of fascinated by this little box that, you know, our uncle had sort of taken custody of them for a little while. My grandfather died in 2000, so my uncle sort of took custody of the coins for a little while and then gave them to my older brother, and then my older brother eventually shared them with me. And when we were young, we would just kind of pour them all out onto the carpet or onto the floor and just kind of go through them. And even though we'd seen the same coins time after time, we were still just kind of fascinated by it. And I remember, you know, the dark circulation toning of the silver coins, particularly a couple of silver pesos from Mexico from the 1890s and the first decade of the 20th century. You know, there was something about their appearance that really stuck with me for whatever reason. And so as I got older, I got more and more interested in coins, though somewhat passively, and people would give me, you know, coins as gifts. The same uncle that took custody of the coins sent an American Silver Eagle and a 2005 mint set, and kind of, you know, just little odds and ends that I just kind of put together. My parents, I got a whole bunch of Susan B. Anthony dollars from my parents because when they were living in New Orleans in the 80s, they somehow got roped into going to a timeshare presentation that promised to give them money if they sat through the whole thing. Apparently, and you know, anyone who's ever even heard of a timeshare presentation knows that they keep finding ways to loop you in. And so my parents sit through this thing, and it takes them like, you know, hours to extricate themselves, you know, because they have all the different people trying to sell them timeshares. And then when they got to the end, their compensation was given to them in Susan B. Anthony dollars. And And my parents were so fried and annoyed that my dad swore, he's like, these are going to be worth something someday, and we're going to be so glad we did this. So as I got more and more into coins for years, my dad would ask me, so what are the Susan B's worth? Are they worth anything yet? They were all 1979s too. there weren't even any of the slightly less common dates. They were all super common. So,
well, so my family also, so like after I did the badge, my dad gave me his collection. It was pretty good. It had a bunch of like mid-1800s, late-1800s U.S. silver. Nothing crazy, but it definitely sparked my interest in American silver, especially like the trimes and the 3-cent nickels, because he had a good chunk of those, which were really cool. But what was more interesting for me in general, and looking back on it now, is my grandparents would, whenever they traveled, they would bring back like just pocket change from the countries. And then one time my grandmother, she must have had this from before because she hadn't been to Russia in a long time. But she gave me, I think it's from like 76, mid 70s, a proof mint set from the USSR, which is insanely cool. And it's got the cardboard box and everything. And so I'm doing that now myself. So when I travel, I try and pick up the general pocket change, some of the bills, but then also I try and visit a coin shop in every place I go if I can. So like when I was in Poland, I picked up some Polish 3 pokers. I picked up a really cool commemorative silver coin from Chernobyl when I went there. I got a really cool 10 Pauli paper bill from Rome, from Napoleon, the Napoleonic Republic he set up, stuff like that. So I'm trying to build up alongside my just like pure collection. I'm trying to build up like a collection of memories with it, which I find really cool.
Yeah, I did something similar, but in a much less considered way when I was studying abroad too, because I was in Vienna and I went to, there were two or three, I think two coin shops in the city that I went to a couple times, and I bought a few things. And then when I was in Salzburg, I found another coin shop and I bought some, you know, some small, I think they're referred to as silver pennies.
I'm pretty sure we went to the same shop in Salzburg.
Yeah, well, if it was right on one of those really narrow sort of alley streets near, yeah, not too far from the church near the hill. Anyway, mm-hmm. or near the mountain where the castle is.
Yeah.
Anyway, I can't remember the name of it. It used to be the wallpaper on my phone. So I have a couple of, you know, Salzburg, you know, little silver coins that I bought when I was there. I bought some coins in Vienna. But I didn't have the presence of mind to, you know, when I was in Amsterdam or Paris or, you know, Prague, I didn't have the presence of mind to seek out a coin shop. I wish that I had, but I do have a few coins from my numismatic travels.
Well,
so, well, I was going to say, you know, the euro being adopted, you know, in the early 2002, I guess, when it started circulating. I mean, that really was like the end of the road for a lot of those very individualized modern coin issues for the different European countries. So, you know, I've been to, you know, most of Europe since then, and, you know, getting Eurozone coinage just doesn't feel the same as, like, you know, having a pocket full of whatever you couldn't spend and can't use in the next country you go to, and on and on.
That's why
I'm sure if you live there, that would be annoying. But, you know, as a tourist, it's a different experience.
Yeah, that's why I like Eastern Europe so much, because they haven't quite gotten there yet. But I also found, and I told Chris this, and we both had a good laugh of it. When you're looking for coin shops online, it's not the easiest thing to do in foreign countries, because A, different languages, and B, they don't always advertise for obvious reasons. But I would always search like coins, antique shops, numismatic shops online, and there's a department store chain, like clothing, Macy's type store chain in Eastern Europe in the Balkans called Coin. Coins. And so whenever you're Googling or Google mapping like coin shops, that pops up. So it's kind of a pain.
You know, I'm so sad that I didn't accidentally like do the same thing that you did, but accidentally stumble into an Austrian cash for gold seminar. Like, I would have had no idea what was going on, but it would have been really funny.
Yeah, that would be cool.
You guys ever have a chance to go to any of the coin shows when you're in Europe?
No, I was a Peace Corps volunteer the second time, and so my travel was way more restricted than I would like it to have been. So I kept trying to place myself in Germany during the big shows, but nah, I've never managed to.
Yeah, the shows are actually quite amazing. I mean, if you imagine, like, the American shows tend to have sort of the, I guess they're more like, you know, based on the high profile auctions if you go to a national show. And then each of the dealers are selling, you know, their whatever their specialty and certified coins usually, but, you know, paper money and the other types of objects. And then the European shows, especially like the bigger ones, like I'm, you know, like the World's Money Fair in Berlin, which is usually held the end of January, early February each year, in the old East Germany part of town. That show is like every bit as much a trade show for the industry, the minting industry, as it is a rare coin show, vintage coin show. You know, they have the big Kunker auction, and that's definitely cool to go to and see those coins and metals. The dealers tend to be like on the, I would call it like almost the vestibule of the show floor. You know, they're sort of on the outside, and you get the sense that like what they're doing there is less important to the show than the, you know, the Monte de Perry or the Italian mint, the Roman mint, the mint of Poland, the Royal Canadian Mint, the Royal Mint of England, the Royal Australian Mint, Perth Mint, and all of those modern coin manufacturers. And then there's a hall for machinery, you know, the service industry that like produces the heavy equipment for the mints. And just as a somebody who was numismatically oriented and trying to consider what this industry is like, seeing the fact that like so much technology and R&D and effort and marketing and, you know, even like the perspectives I think the European mints have about coins places them in sort of a luxury goods category, if you will, you know, kind of like a lifestyle brands, and contrasting that to what it's like in the American market where, you know, the mint is many things, but I don't think it projects itself to be a luxury item type of producer. And coin shows in America, you can find some of the most expensive coins imaginable, but they're never presented in a way that is aspirational. You know, they're in slabs or they're at, you know, dealer tables and porcelain floors with, you know, no carpeting on the floor. And, you know, it's just, there's no, we don't dress it up, you know, whereas at the World Money Fair in Berlin, I mean, that's an elegant show floor, if you ask me.
I'm curious, do you think just a different viewpoints that people have about what coins and coin collecting and numismatics and the industry is supposed to be and who it's supposed to be for. And in the US there seems to be for a while, there seems to have been a change, kind of a sea change from, Chris and I have talked about this, from like it's being an every man kind of industry or hobby to being more for the elites. And I feel like Europe has been there for a lot longer. We as the nouveau riche country we are, shot up into the millions of dollars for a coin. I mean, the Eidmar gold, Eidmar that just sold insane dollars. But then Europe has just had this just entrenched class of collectors for thousands of years. I think there's a difference in perspective that comes with age.
Well, what you both said reminded me of a conversation I've had with Charles and Tyler. I think you and I've talked about this too. You know, it strikes me that the lack of pomp and circumstance that you describe, Charles, do you think, or do either of you think that that's a product of the kind of financialization of numismatics over the last, you know, number of years, last few decades? Totally. Do you think that that's a product of it?
Yeah, 100%. Charles and I have talked about this, about the slabbing of coins and how it's generally become an industry or an industrial way for people to be assured of the value, and it's an easier route into the collector market and whatever. I still think it's fascinating that the only two coins you can put in a Roth IRA are a silver eagle and a golden buffalo.
Well, I think with coins, you know, for in the United States, you know, is in some respects, I mean, we're behind on certain in certain areas, but as far as the monetization of coins, I think we've been way ahead, essentially since the probably the mid to late 70s. You know, obviously the grading of coins created a tremendous amount of arbitrage for these objects and allowed, you know, allow them to be more liquid than they would have been. I mean, if you think about like that Eidmar coin that sold for a couple million dollars, I don't think that coin would have sold for a couple million dollars if there wasn't a $1794 that sold for $10 million, if there wasn't a 1933 Double Eagle that sold in 2001 for $7 million, if there wasn't, you know, a drumbeat of very valuable U.S. coins that have sold for the past several decades, you know, going all the way back to like, you know, I think the 1913 nickel was almost the first coin to sell for $1 million. I think it sold for one bit under that. And I think that that led the U.S. coin industry to revolutionize the way collectors are able to look at quality. I think slabs are important in that respect. And talking about like going to European auctions, you know, a lot of European auctions, you know, when they have lot viewing, you know, the coins are like susceptible to like handling. And it's almost like for, at least for modern machine made issues, you want to definitely make sure you're like, you're the last person or one of the last people to look at the lot before it goes up for sale, because like somebody could get a fingerprint or do something to it. It literally can look different when you bid on it than when you saw it at a lot viewing, because they are in the raw. And I know like the Europeans are reluctant to adopt American grading practices, but I explained to them that, you know, if you're a coin dealer, professional coin dealer, the way you sustain your business is by making sure that not only can you sell the coin to a client, but that that coin is worth selling to the next client. So you want to make sure that when you get that coin back, it's as close to the state of preservation it was in when you sold it the first time. You know, it doesn't do you any good to give, you know, like let's go to the 70s, right? When people were using PVC, you know, to sell a collector, you know, thousands of dollars worth of coins that get put in a PVC pouch, the pouch starts to disintegrate, the coins become, you know, start to disintegrate along with the pouch. And then some of the coins you can rescue and some of the coins you can't. So if we allow that attrition to happen, you know, through the way, you know, the way collecting usually was done, then that reduces the amount of material a dealer can sell, and it puts a finite limit on the growth potential of the industry. Whereas with a slab coin, you know, it's not foolproof, it's not perfect, but it does allow that, it does give that coin something to save it from careless handling or from elemental issues. And I think that if I was a European collector, it's not so much the grading that would be the important thing for me. It would be the preservation of the object. I do think that the grading is interesting too, though, because the interesting thing about grading is if you look at it as shorthand and not like the, you know, the gospel truth, then it allows you to start seeing the coin different ways and sets up the potential for you to kind of develop a knowledge of the condition census. And you may not agree with the experts. You may be, you know, an expert yourself and not agree with another expert. Or you may not agree with the grading services, but you can develop a skill to say, well, this MS66 taller, it's weakly struck in the top left, and these other two are better struck, and I don't like the color of the coin, but you know, the grading service says it's an MS66, and these two that are MS65s I find better. But still, at least you're kind of winnowing down the population to make it more discreet, so you can have those conversations. Whereas if nothing got graded, then it requires an individual or a researcher to just kind of have a better knowledge of what's out in the market than what might be possible. And I think in the last 15, 20 years, with the way a lot of online coin trading has, you know, a lot of records for online coin transactions have been preserved, that, you know, we can know more about what survives in the market than we ever could in the past. And then the thing that we asked about why the U.S. market might be a little different, or the way we present coins is different. I think a large part of that in America is because coin dealing, like the trading of coins, essentially takes place with like sole proprietors. And we think of ourselves as having an industry, and you know, by definitionally it is, but we conduct this industry by, you know, sole proprietors setting up their own thing, and their focus is dealing the coin. It's not so much setting up an elegant booth or presentation or you know, maintaining the facade of sophistication. It's also a knowledge industry, you know, like the better dealers tend to be the ones with the most knowledge. And, how do you dress up knowledge? It's very difficult, to dress up knowledge. So I think by and large, it's just the way coins are traded, in America that puts us in that position. And maybe to some extent, and I'm not trying to denigrate anybody, but it could also be a lack of imagination, you know, on the part of the way we present ourselves, that goes all the way to the coin, from the coin publications to the coin clubs, to the coin conventions, to the coin dealers, to the, you know, the marketers or whatever. It could just be our own lack of imagination.
Most modern coins need slabs of some variety. Yes. One of the reasons why I love ancient coins so much is I love holding them. I love feeling them. I love moving them back and forth in the light to see the toning. I just, the weight of them, and you don't get that with a slab. And that is why I personally don't have any coins in my collection that have slabs.
Yeah, I'm a little bit less European in my tastes, I guess. I have a number of slabbed coins. Some of the more expensive coins I own are slabbed, though a couple of the more expensive coins I have are raw. Charles, the two things you said made me think of conversations that I've had with both of you before. The first of which has to do with the sort of, you know, the collector view of the hobby versus the sort of insider or professional view of the hobby. And I certainly wouldn't class myself in the insider camp by any means. And I came into numismatics from a kind of wide-eyed, you know, and it's childlike in the most literal sense, kind of sense of wonder at how fascinating coins are. But what you're talking about, Charles, and what you said about, you know, analyzing certified populations and, you know, being able to analyze, you know, looking at coins through a deeply analytical lens. And the more knowledge someone has, the more sophisticated their sort of analytical lenses become. And they're more able to perceive things like, you know, first you can check for cleaning, or you can look at strike quality, or you can, you know, gauge whether that toning looks, you know, real or not, or looks, you know, authentic. Or one of the funniest things, and Tyler, I know you'll get a kick out of this, is a dealer that Tyler and I both know once kept a coin in I don't think it was a major company slab, but it said questionable toning, which I just thought was a really, it was just kind of a funny, funny label and a funny grade to assign to a coin. But you know, what you're describing, Charles, is kind of this inside baseball, kind of insider market knowledge. And I think that for some people who are just kind of wide-eyed at how fascinating coins can be, I think it can be not deflating or disillusioning necessarily, but I think that it can be a little bit daunting when confronted with not only a dealer who's incredibly knowledgeable and can, you know, just sort of, you know, rattle off a list of interesting factoids and, you know, displays really detailed market knowledge, but it can be a little bit daunting to understand that there are all of these layers of complexity that sort of the quote unquote every collector doesn't get to see. And it's not to say that those layers of complexity aren't worth learning about. It's to suggest that there's a dimension to it that I think some people who are just pure collectors don't necessarily see, though of course the most experienced or sophisticated collectors do become familiar with those dynamics, because once you get to a certain level and you're collecting a certain quality material or you're trying to complete certain sets, eventually you do run up against that. But I think that for particularly less experienced collectors, there's, you know, that there's not that degree of inside knowledge, or there's at least just not a sense of how deep it actually goes. So, You know, that's something I've been thinking about a lot since I started working professionally in the industry about 2.5-ish years ago.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Tom.
Sorry about that. I've also run up against that myself when I was first starting. You go to the shows, and I tagged along with a local dealer to a couple shows 6-7 years ago. And I was just kind of blown away with how do I make a decision on what to buy, what to get, what to trade for, blah, blah, blah. And so now, while I've learned a bit more, and thanks to Chris, I've kind of gotten into the quote unquote industry. I write for you guys, and I'm trying to do a little bit of a dealing thing on my own side. But I purposefully, more than most, put myself out there and say to people, young collectors, young numismatics, I'm always there if you have questions. Don't worry about reaching out to me privately. I will always answer your questions. If you need help identifying a coin, I'm more than happy to help. And I think that we need more people who are willing to be open and available for collectors. I know there are definitely some who are asking questions for just to take up your time, and there are people who are too busy legitimately, but I think in general we need to make a bigger effort to be welcoming to the new collectors and the new segment of our
and that makes me think of the second thing that I was going to mention that Charles said that had kind of made me think of conversations I've had with both of you, which is, you know, what seems to be a lack of imagination. And I don't know that I would couch it in those terms specifically, but I hear a lot of people, you know, asking, how do we appeal to a broader cross section of people? Or, you know, how do we make this more engaging, whether it's for younger people or just a broader audience? And I don't have any concrete answers, but I can't help but think that one of the best podcasts, when I was hosting the Coin World podcast, one of the best interviews we had was with a guy who ran I have to look that up now.
Well, let me chime in, and then you can
bring back.
Okay, one of the things I would say is I didn't have the scouting experience, you know, when I got into coins, but I was aided or brought into the hobby completely by chance, discovering my grandmother's coin collection, and because I pestered her enough about it, you know, she gave me a red book. And it's funny because I was sitting on the couch earlier tonight talking to my wife, and I was reading an article that was published in, I think, the January 1970 Numismatist. I mean, this tells you kind of how I nerd out. And it was a profile of Dick Yeoman, R.S. Yeoman. And I was telling her, it's like I showed her a picture of him, and I said, you know, this guy essentially changed my life. Because, you know, he created the penny board, which I'm sure, you know, maybe all of us have used, but also, you know, the red book, you know, was, still being edited by him when I got my first one in 1984. And I remember, you know, just looking at that book and looking at every type of coin in that book, seeing all the pictures, seeing all the mintages, seeing all the prices. And the great thing about it was that, like, as a youngster, you saw coins like priced at like good and very good and fine. And so everything seemed to be a lot more affordable. Now that we live in a market where, you know, I think most adult collectors aren't buying good coins. You know, you start talking about mint state, this and that, then the coins become very expensive very quickly. But for me as a collector, and also as a writer, I think it became apparent to me and important to me to put the red book away and to stop thinking about my own collecting in terms of building sets or feeling like I needed this rarity or that this type or that type. I found that, like, there were so many areas to collect that did not require set building, that did not require a tremendous amount of money but were rewarding because they allowed you to learn something important about a topic, a place, a time, and have a memento of it. And, you know, in my own collection, you know, this is not humble bragging or anything, but, you know, I have coins in my own collection, which have mintages of like, you know, 10, 20, 30 pieces that if they were American coins, they would be hundreds of thousands of dollars. But because they're, you know, from Paraguay or they're from, you know, West Germany or some other place, you know, that has a collecting culture, but isn't that driven by price. You know, I have things that are very hard to find and I was able to afford. And if I would have stayed in that Red Book mode as a writer, you know, I'd be writing about Susan B. Anthony dollars half the time or whatever it is that I could afford to buy. And I think that that's a mistake for writers trying to go from being a hobbyist to becoming a writer. Now, on the other hand, I do think that it's important when we talk about imagination to present the coins people can afford and do collect and present them in mature, sophisticated ways. And I've always been somebody who believes that, you know, an Athenian owl is an important coin, but so is, a 1974 Lincoln cent. And if you treat coins as numismatic objects and take away the prejudice that you might have based on its rarity or its recent mintage or, you know, just its commonness, then I think what you allow is for the collector to feel that what they have, as humble as it is, if they're just starting, is important and interesting. And when you guys were kids and you were going to your first coin show in Boston, I mean, sounds, Tyler, to me like you came to play. You got some pretty nice stuff. But
I went with like $30 and I came back with what I got.
Yeah. Yeah. So the point is that, like, it's okay. Like, I want anybody listening to this podcast to realize it doesn't matter if you have $50 to buy a coin or $5,000 to buy a coin or $10,000 to buy a coin. You can make a great purchase for that amount of money. You can make a horrendously bad purchase for that amount of money. But the fact is, the more you put into the hobby of your own self and your own enthusiasm for learning about it and your own appreciation for the object, it really doesn't matter where you're playing at, because, you know, there are so many areas of coin collecting or paper money collecting, metal and token collecting. There really is a spot and a pocket for everybody. And I think that, like, you know, learning the standard way people do things is important to get you started and acclimated. But the sooner you learn what you need to learn from the Red Book and the sooner you put it away to start, like, expanding the way you appreciate the hobby, the better off you're going to be.
Well, there are articles I write which are totally glorifying certain coins or events, like the shipwreck one that went up. All of those coins in that article are worth hundreds of thousands of dollars, and you can't get them because either they're looted coins or they're in museums. But I generally try and demystify ancient coins. I mean, you were just talking about how you're trying to raise the awareness that more common coins can be desirable. I'd like to go the opposite way, saying that ancient coins can be more accessible. I mean, there are tons of them out there and most of them aren't that expensive. And while a lot of people I know say buy the book, not the coin, or buy the book first, then the coin, which is a very important thing to do. You need to know what you're doing before you get into buying things, as you just rightfully said. It's not that hard to get that information. There are definite sources out there, and they're easily accessible. Most of them are free. Databases like Wildwinds and AC Search and Coin Archives, and while they're paid versions of those, the free versions are just as adequate for most people's needs. And they're really good sources to study these coins, which for most people are kind of beyond the veil of what they consider accessible, because most of these coins, people are seeing examples in museums, and they're just like, I know I used to be like, how could I ever get one of those? That's so cool. I could never own something that's in a museum. And now, years later, I have coins that, again, not to brag, because that's not the point of this, is that are generally unique. Granted, it's because there's a specific device on the obverse or reverse, and it's not at all a specific coin, a special coin besides that. But there are these coins that are generally accessible that most people don't understand about, that I'm trying to demystify through most of my articles.
I've found myself gravitating towards material that anchors itself in a very specific place and time. I had never, before I started working in numismatics professionally, to the extent that I could be said to be doing that, before I started doing that, and before I started, you know, before I became a member of a lot of Facebook auction groups, and before I started going to more shows and being exposed to more material, I had never really considered ephemera as something to collect. Like, it had never occurred to me to go and buy an old check. Like, that had never crossed my mind as something that I would have been interested in. But in the last couple of years, I found myself fascinated by, among a number of other things, you know, pieces of ephemera like old checks and stock certificates, precisely because they usually have some identifying writing that anchors it in a specific place and time. If it's issued by a particular bank, it tells you what city it's in. It tells you on what day of what year, you know, it was made out for. And, you know, in some cases, there are also really cool revenue stamps on some pieces like that, and other sort of similar, more philatelic items. And I find those things compelling to the extent that one of my professors in college once, you know, he talked about what draws people to history, and he talked about how, you know, having historical imagination, being able to kind of put yourself in a particular location or a particular locale or a particular period of time, and being able to visualize that is a quality that attracts a lot of people to history, as whether as a discipline or just as something to read and think about. And I find that's easier with items that do have that specific, you know, that are, like I said, anchored in a specific context. And, you know, very recently, I actually found out that my grandfather, the one who's my paternal grandfather, the one who's the first collection that I inherited, you know, I actually just found out that there are actually a couple of items from that collection that we hadn't seen yet, that my uncle had in his own coin collection. Short snorters that were made out, you know, by the crew of the ship on September 7th of 1945. And again, not only does that anchor it in a specific context, but it's a context that has, you know, deep personal significance to me. So items like that, you know, really interest me more and more. And then as far as to get back to the topic of imagination and kind of how the hobby markets itself, I found the podcast, by the way, guys. one of my favorite interviews that Jeff Stark and I did together on the Coin World podcast was a conversation we had with a guy named Dave Norris. And he and his son created a club at his son's school called the Legacy Knights Numismatic Society. He talked about how the sort of shortcomings that he saw in how the hobby traditionally markets itself to younger people. And he talked about how he didn't really start this club with his son necessarily because he wanted to teach kids to become really advanced numismatists, though he was certainly happy if he had, you know, planted a seed of interest. And if some of the kids eventually did get involved in the hobby, he was certainly excited about that. But he brought up what I thought was an important dynamic, where in terms of appealing, and this doesn't just apply to younger people, I think this applies to people outside of numismatics in general. But he talked about how when dealers approach particularly younger customers, right, and they're trying to get kids interested, they go, hey, you know, come here and check out these cool coins I have. And he said that's all well and good, and sometimes that can be effective if your pitch, you know, lands or sparks interest. But he couched it in a different way, and he said that his focus was, hey, you know, I think, you know, you kids are really cool. You know, do you want to check out the stuff that I have? And his point was that it was trying to reach out and make a connection and sort of have that community or that sense of community or that sense of, we're not just interested in coins, we're interested in one another. And I thought that, you know, the sort of deeper lesson that I saw in that was, important as it is to, you know, have conversations like this and to, you know, learn as much as we can about our respective fields and areas of specialty, you know, it's also important to create a community. And it's important, and I think the lesson that I absorbed from that for the hobby more broadly, not just for outreach, was it's important to create sort of a social space where people can come together, not only share their interest, but, you know, you know, create a sense of camaraderie and community. That's a really important part of having a hobby. Is it's not just about buying objects. It's about, you know, connecting with other people and seeing what we all have in common. So,
well, I've always felt that coins are, or I mean, I say coins, it's sort of a placeholder term for all of this. Yeah, I've always felt that these were interesting things collected by interesting people. And one of the biggest things, I guess, the biggest development in my experience as a numismatist, probably I would say I wasn't a numismatist until this dawned on me, was that I started to really focus on learning about the way the hobby developed over like the last century and a half. And numismatic periodicals, I think, like, again, if you're an ANA member, if you're not, you should be. But the ANA has digitized every issue of Numismatists from its beginnings. You can read over 100 years of it. And if you go back to like the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s Numismatists, you see coin collectors communicating their love and appreciation for coins with other coin collectors. And these coin collectors often would write articles, but they were writing articles for other coin collectors. And if you're reading it, you're seeing a social space. Today, I think, like, you know, maybe the numismatist feels commercial because it looks like it's a very slick and elegant product, professionally put together. And maybe to its detriment, it doesn't feel like coin collectors talking to coin collectors. Another magazine that's defunct, but was Lee Hewitt's Numismatic Scrapbook magazine, which was around for probably 1936, I think, the first edition, and then Amos bought it in the around 1969.
Yeah, it was late '60s.
Yeah, late 60s. And then David Alexander was the editor for a while before it was shut down, probably around the bicentennial.
Yeah, I actually researched Numismatic Scrapbook a couple of months ago. Yeah, it was in the 70s when it shut down.
Yeah, yeah. So I think I have every issue of that magazine from 1938 to when it ended. And again, that magazine, you know, in its heyday in the 50s, 60s, it was coin collectors talking to coin collectors. I found this in my change, or I found this variety, or here's like everything I look like. The one guy who went to Asia and got some Asian banknotes, here's everything I know about them. And I think in a lot of respects, like this shows how much the hobby benefited from people sharing their enthusiasm and excitement for it. And the coin collecting scene was a very social space. You would see like prominent numismatists throughout the country. And when you do their biographies or would read their, you know, their obituaries, you would always see that so-and-so was instrumental in establishing the Buffalo Numismatic Association, or so-and-so was a charter member of Central States, or so-and-so set up a coin club in Palo Alto, or wherever it was. You know, these collectors found the community aspect of coin collecting as important as building their collections. They found exhibiting their coins part of their sort of like a rite of passage for being a numismatist, a serious numismatist. They were all part of a scene. And I think, you know, we've gotten lucky in the sense that we have this great hobby that we've inherited from these people. But I don't want us to lose sense of the fact that this is a scene, you know, and whether it's a Discord, if you're on that's talking about coins to get a little bit younger here, or, you know, you're in a Facebook group, or if you do some coins on Instagram or whatever, you know, do YouTube videos or whatever it is that expresses your experience in coins. It's a continuation of what actually made this hobby thrive and grow. And so to me, like, the social aspect is very important. We aren't collecting objects. We're really building relationships, not only with the objects and with history, but with each other.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'm curious to hear, you know, from both of you. Do you see, you know, I think social media has provided a venue to express the kind of enthusiasm that you're talking about, Charles, the enthusiasm that you saw back in, you know, in past issues of the Numismatist. Do you all see a similar level of enthusiasm and that kind of exuberant just joyfulness that people seem to take in it? Do you guys see that, or do you think that's something that's faded a little bit with time?
Well, so I can't speak as much to the modern market because most of the groups I'm in people I talk to are collectors of ancient, medieval and ancient coins. But yeah, it's still there. Lots of people are just really excited about the cool coins they have or looking for or that other people post. And it really is a nice community. And it's great to see people reaching out if they have questions or if they just want to show something cool they got. I know I love doing that. When I get a cool coin, I always do a little write-up about the history and the attributions and all that stuff and the provenance, if there is any. And then I shoot it up, and I love having the conversations with people about that. And if someone posted a coin from Antiochus, from the Seleucid Empire, and then someone posted one from the Ptolemaic Empire or wherever, and you want to compare and contrast and say, oh, here's mine. And they're like, oh, well, here's mine. And a great thing about the Facebook groups is while you can do that in shows and in club meetings, not everyone brings their coins. So you can say, oh, I have one, but you can't compare them. You can't be like, oh, hey, look, mine's got this, but yours has that. And while mine may not be as good grade, it's got a nice little bit of toning on the obverse. And it's really good to be able to share what you have. But by doing so, you're building the relationships with the other collectors. And that's one of the reasons why I like writing so much, is because while it's an awesome job to do, and you're a good editor, and it's flexible, and it's really enjoyable in that aspect, I get to share what I love. It's almost always interesting topics. I don't think I haven't had a topic yet that I didn't like to write about. And it's great. I'm learning new stuff, and I'm sharing what I love.
Every generation that approaches its hobby is going to have, like, you know, its standout figures, and it's going to have its, like, people who kind of go above and beyond and create an impact. And I don't know who those people necessarily are going to be, amongst the people I don't personally know about already, but they're coming, and they won't make themselves known. With Coin Week, you know, as the editor of Coin Week and having been involved in this project for about 5-6 years now, you know, I just wanted to create the type of numismatic publication that I myself would want to read. So I just took the approach that, you know, do what you think would be interesting if you were reading it. When I assign topics to writers I respect, I try to assign them things that I want to read. Like, I don't know enough about this, but it's interesting, and I know you're smart. So tell me what it is I want to know. And I just hope that the audience finds those topics as interesting and compelling as I do. And then again, the other thing is that I think every single object in numismatics is worth being valorized to a certain extent. I think that from the most humble to the most expensive coins, they all have a space. The most important coin I ever saw in my life, and I've held like the Child's 1804 dollar, which is probably worth over $10 million. But the most important coin I ever saw in my life was that first magical coin that got me into coin collecting. And it was the 1983 Olympics dollar that was like loose and rustling about in my grandmother's safe, which she had left open when I was visiting when I was in first grade. And that's how I discovered coins, that she collected coins, and that the Mint made these like proof coins that were different than anything I'd ever seen or spent. And that coin is, you know, worth a little bit more than the silver that was used to strike it. But for me, it was like the beginning of a lifelong experience. I don't even own an example of that coin, but it had never left me. You know, the idea that that like this is a really interesting and cool hobby. And I've never had the discipline to build and build and build a collection. I always go through these cycles where I have like a potlatch where I get rid of things and I start over. And you know, that's true for coin collecting and for any other type of collecting I've been involved with. But my current iteration of coin collecting is, you know, is disparate areas of interest, a lot of metals, more world coins than US coins at this point. But the largest and most important part of my collection is like my numismatic library, which is really what connects me to all of this. And, you know, the coins that I know the most about are coins I could never afford. So, and I don't feel like I'm missing something by not owning them. I feel like I've gained so much more by like making them tangible for me, by like doing so much work, researching them and appreciating them, you know, like studying drape bust dollars by die variety, you know, for that to really matter to you as a collector, you have to have some serious skrilla. But if as a researcher and somebody who looks at it and finds that it helps you understand the way they made dies, and then you carry that knowledge over to other series, and then you carry that forward and see how the mint developed over time, and then you think about the way the economy developed, then you think about the way a politics developed, and then eventually you get to the point where you like you start seeing changes in iconography. You know, you go from liberty to effigies of Native Americans at a time when America was still fighting wars on the frontier and denying Native Americans rights, to getting rid of liberty and those idealizations of American identity and replacing them with an imperial coinage where it's presidents and founding fathers. All of this, I think, is part of like understanding America in a way that I think somebody who doesn't devote a lot of time to numismatics will never understand.
And you can understand other countries. And I know, Tyler, you've done some of this with some of the Balkan states. You do the same thing with world coins and other countries as well. And I can't remember who said it, and I'm sure I'm going to butcher the quote, but a fairly famous numismatist, again, who I apparently can't remember, said that, you know, whoever owns, you know, the books on the series, you know, if they've spent the time to study those books and to learn everything that's in them, that person is as much of a numismatist as someone who's put together a spectacular collection of whatever kind of material. So yeah, I absolutely, you know, that's something I've been working on too, since I started working, you know, working in the industry, was, you know, I've built a larger, you know, I'm in the process of building a numismatic library, and I'm building it continuously. And it's a lot of fun, because even if some of the material isn't completely up to date, it's really interesting to read essays that people wrote. You know, Charles, you mentioned the Archives of the Numismatist. I've had, you know, for research for different pieces that I've written, I've dug through a lot of back issues of the Numismatist, and I want to go through and read them more systematically at some point in the future. But it is really interesting to see the way that people used to write about coins and compare that to how people write about coins now, the things that they chose to emphasize, you know, the way that they, you know, the way that they graded things or the way that they were thinking about it. And, you know, I find, you know, reading that evolution is really interesting. And I found that really, you know, really engaging. So I definitely hear what you're saying in terms of, you know, it gives you a new way to look at the world. And that's one of the things I've enjoyed the most, is finding, you know, my eye for history and my eye for numismatics changing over time. And I found that, you know, occasionally unsettling, but ultimately enjoyable.
So in how, on my version of that, I have a tiny little library, and I maybe have like 10 books. I borrow what I need or what I want from Chris. but what I've been trying to do is, my main collecting kick, and has been for a while, is Greek tetradrachms, or Hellenistic tetradrachms. But I've also tried to do on the side for a lot less money, which this may also interest other collectors, is I've been trying to connect myself personally to numismatics. So, for example, I lived in Macedonia, North Macedonia, for a while as a Peace Corps volunteer. I just recently picked up a 1991 first issue paper bill from them, a buck from like my local coin shop's $1 paper money bin. But it's the first one they issued after they got their independence. So I got that. When I went to Belgrade, I picked up a keychain from the House of Flowers, which was Josip Broz Tito's tomb. And I didn't realize until a year later that it was, actually, like a pewter copy of a commemorative 50 dinar, coin. And so I then, being me, decided I'm going to get that cool coin. And so I searched and I found the proof set with it in it for like 20, 30 bucks. And now I have that really cool coin and it's connecting, back to a place I really enjoyed visiting. And I've done that with other coins, and other, numismatic items where I'm trying to connect myself to the hobby in a way that, brings me closer to the history and the cultural importance of the pieces, whether or not, it's, a valuable coin or not. That's not the point. I just picked up my first English hammered coin the other day. It's slightly smoothed. It's been tooled. It's got some toning. It's not great, but it's an Elizabeth the First sixpence, and it's a cool coin. It's no great shakes, but that's not the point. And I'm trying to connect myself with places and historical periods I enjoy learning about. And I feel like people get too, especially with modern coins, too pigeonholed into the type or the denomination that they collect. And while, yeah, just like you said, Charles, you can always just scrap what you're doing and start afresh. But there's only so much you can do with modern US. I mean, you can dig into the nitty gritty, but eventually you'll run up against, parts of a collection that are just too expensive for normal people with normal budgets. But with world coins, it's infinite practically. And ancient coins just adds another level on top of that. And it allows people to customize their collecting in ways that, provide personal enjoyment out of it. And I just find that really important for myself. Like I picked up a coronation medal from Queen Victoria recently, and it came in the original little paper envelope. Like that is, for me, the envelope is cooler than the coin, because a coin will survive a couple hundred years, but a little paper envelope that was meant to be thrown away, basically, that's another thing. I'm also getting into collecting coin tags. The paper square or circular tags that come along with most ancient coins that you buy. I mean, the oldest one I have is a couple decades, nothing fancy. But like if you buy a coin or somehow end up with a coin from a famous collection from a marquis or a duke or king or whatever, or JP Morgan or whatever. Those are really collectible tags and they're interesting. And to me, that's almost more important than the coin itself. Cause one of my dream articles, and I don't know if I'll be able to do this. I have something similar in with the numismatist, for they're still looking at it, whether or not they're going to publish it, but is to do like a life of a coin and track it as much as you can from when it was struck to today. And Chris and I have this long running project that we would love to actually start. I would is it's about chop marks. And basically like being able to to track a coin. How cool is that? The story behind it. If I have a, I think it's a Charles VIII or something, one of the Spanish silver reals from the end of the 1700s. It's got 30, 40 chop marks. I would love to be able to somehow figure out where those were made, where the chop marks were placed on the coin. I know where the coin was minted. I know where I bought it. but I don't know anything else about it. How cool would it be to track a coin like that?
No, that would be a fascinating project, Tyler. Okay, guys, I think that's a good summation of our experience, at least for this time on the Coin Week podcast. I'd like to thank Tyler Rossi and Chris Bullfinks for joining me. And we'll be back next week with an interesting and insightful conversation with Ken Brissett about R.S. Yeoman, the creator of the Red Book, one of the figures I think may be one of the most important numismatists of the 20th century. For Coin Week, I'm editor Charles Morgan. Until next time, happy collecting. If you like this podcast, please share it with your friends. Remember, you can download every episode of the Coin Week podcast for free on the iTunes Store, stream it online on our YouTube channel, or on coinweek.com. For Coin Week, I'm editor Charles Morgan. Until next time, happy collecting.